Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to today's session. As you saw from the first slide earlier, we're talking about unexpected theater, theater storytelling, staged readings, reader's theater, and other ways that we can get things that normally aren't plays into areas that normally aren't theater. So what you just heard was the story, The Case of Vincent Pierwit, a 19th century British ghost story. And thanks, Sam. We had never rehearsed or run that together before, so that was interesting. As some of you know, in addition to my theater work, I'm also the manager of the James J. Hill House in St. Paul, Minnesota. So it's a big 19th century house, and one of the kinds of programs that we like to do is to create different kinds of experiences for people to let them know, okay, what were people doing at that time period? Well, they wrote letters, so we did one program, a similar dramatized program like this on letters, and then a whole series that would be, as you see, on 19th century ghost stories, poetry, Christmas stories, and these are all examples of reader's theater where you would have people in costume. Obviously, we've been doing this for many, many years, as you can tell. We use music stands. We're editing scripts down, taking out the he said, she said, stuff like that that we don't know, that we don't really need to know then. We're adding a little bit of movement in. We'll, you know, usually in each story, like in the ghost stories, we try to put one like little trick thing in there, like having the disembodied voice suddenly come out of nowhere or something, just like in the story. And as you see, it's usually just about an hour long, and it's something that is done with very, very little rehearsal then, too. And the actors don't need to be off book, but still it gives them an idea of, like, what were the kind of stories that people were listening to then, and why were those important, and why might they still work for us even today? So something like The Case of Vincent Pierwit that you just heard touches on two important themes in Victorian ghost stories: apprehension about the servant class that was living and working in your same house in a big mansion like this, and apprehension about new technology. In this case, it was simply a telephone. How can there be someone there when there isn't anyone there, too? So maybe we can relate to that a little bit. I'm both an English and a theater major, and this sort of tied into a lot of the work that I was doing in the theater at the time. So I and a number of friends started a small theater company that we had for a number of years, where our tagline was classic texts for contemporary audiences. So we were, again, taking non-dramatic works, things that normally weren't plays that we loved, that people said, oh, boring, who wants to see that, who cares, the old dusty stuff people had never heard of. And so we did these same kind of boiled-down adaptations, trying to retain as much of the original language as we can. We did them fully staged. We did them as fringe shows. We did them as late-night sketch comedy kind of things. So we did things like take 17th century diaries by Samuel Pepys, and I created a one-man show. I actually did that for 5 years. It was lots and lots of fun. We took essays and diaries and letters that great authors had written, Virginia Woolf, Oscar Wilde, Jane Austen, and we did a show about that. I took some of the things that we had done in Victorian ghost stories, took them the next step further as a fully staged thing, and created another piece with these folks right here, and just taking classic American short stories that might work well together and comment on one another, like an early Louisa May Alcott story about her life trying to be a, she wanted to go out and become a servant to see what that was like, and paired that female work experience in the 19th century with another story called Bartleby the Scrivener by Herman Melville. And I have a little excerpt here just to show you sort of like how that might work. Do we have anyone who might want to read Bartleby in this? I'll be the lawyer. Any young, you can be young Bartleby, the scrivener, or sort of the apprentice, the person who's the copyist or the clerk right there. So we want, you can see the, you can see the stage directions there. So it includes direct address. It's a first person story, which are often the easiest to adapt for performance things, because you're already in the storytelling mode with one person giving their point of view. And the lawyer says, "Of course, an indispensable part of a scrivener's business is to verify the accuracy of his copy, word by word. It is a very dull, wearisome, and lethargic affair. One object I had in placing Bartleby so handy to me was to avail myself of his services on such trivial occasions. It was on the third day, I think, that after being much hurried to complete a small affair, I abruptly called to Bartleby. I sat with my head bent over the original on my desk, and my right hand sideways with the copy extended, so that upon emerging from his seat, Bartleby might snatch it and proceed to business. Bartleby, may we examine this claim together immediately?"
"I would prefer not to."
I sat a while in perfect silence, rallying my stunned faculties. And then it occurred to me that my ears had deceived me, or Bartleby had entirely misunderstood my meaning. Bartleby, may we examine this claim together immediately?
I would prefer not.
Prefer not to? Well, what do you mean? Are you moonstruck? I want you to compare this sheet. Here, take it.
I would prefer not.
What had one best do? It's a great short story. If you haven't read it, do so. And it's really fun and totally works on stage just by adapting it down like that. I'm going to give you another model right here. Uh-oh, we're going to need even more readers. This is The Goblin Market, a long narrative poem by, we'll just do this little opening beat right here, by Christina Rossetti. We in the church know her for her lyrics to what wonderful Christmas hymn?
In the Bleak
Midwinter. Yes, thank you. Yeah, but she was a wonderful British poet. We don't need to worry about British dialects. It's about two young women, sisters, Laura and Lizzie, and their encounter with these mysterious goblin men. Do we have a Laura and a Lizzie, two women who might want to just read that? There we have one, Laura and Lizzie right there. I'll be goblin number three, goblin number four, goblin number five, them too. I'll maybe just give you a few sort of cues, sort of directing-wise, and we can see if we can get through this. We'll see how that goes. And ready, set, go.
Morning and evening.
Maids heard the goblins cry.
Come buy our orchard fruits. Come buy.
Come buy.
Apples and quinces.
Lemons and oranges.
Plump, unpecked cherries.
Melons and raspberries.
Bloom, down-cheeked peaches.
Swart-headed mulberries.
Wild, free, born cranberries.
Crab apples.
Blueberries.
Pineapples.
Blackberries.
Apricots.
Strawberries.
All ripe together in summer weather.
Sweet to the tongue.
And sound to eye.
Come by, come by.
Evening by evening,
among the brookside rushes,
Laura bowed her head to hear.
Lizzie veiled her blushes.
Lie close, Laura said, pricking up her golden head. We must not look at goblin men. We must not buy their fruits. Who knows upon what soil they fed their hungry, thirsty roots.
Come by.
Call the goblins.
Hobbling down the glen.
Oh, cried Lizzie. Laura, Laura, you should not peep at goblin men. Lizzie covered up her eyes, covered close lest they should look.
But Laura reared her glossy head and whispered like the restless brook, look, Lizzie, down the glen tramp little men.
I know, there are quite some adventures that Laura and Lizzie have with the goblin men. Well, here's one of the differences when you're adapting a poem because of the rhyme, the rhythm, the meter, and the structure. You can't take out a lot of the he said, she said, so you just have to sort of make them work. But if you have a narrative poem like that, or really many, many poems, they can suddenly have a much greater, more visceral, kind of vibrant life once again, if they're spoken aloud either as reader's theater or if they're even a whole fully staged kind of thing. And I've done The Goblin Market both ways, and it's really wonderfully eerie and creepy and very, very effective. Any questions then about these two, like examples of how you can sort of take a story and sort of make it sing once again? Oh, well, that's wonderful, because guess what? Now it's your turn. We're going to divide up into a few small groups. I'm going to give you like 10 minutes or so, and then maybe we can hear some little poetry reading, so where you guys can come up to the podiums right here. I have maybe for two people some Christina Rossetti, some really short children's poems. Anyone interested in that? I'll let you know the other options are Stephen Crane's Do Not Weep, Maiden, for War is Kind. We have Excelsior by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. And we have, not everyone can do it, The Lips That Touch Liquor Shall Never Touch Mine. Should we start with that one? Who wants to do that? I think this one would probably work best if there were one man and two women.
I'll do it, Miss.
Great.
I'll do it.
Okay.
Great.
Good.
There we go. There you go. So you gotta figure that out. So you guys go off. You get like about 10 minutes. Think about it. The instructions are up there. And if there are a few other people, it's like, oh, I don't want to perform. I don't want to perform. Join up with the group and give them some ideas then, too. And we have some extra copies.
How about the kids one?
How about the kids one? Yeah.
Depends.
Depends.
So then there you go. How small a kid do you need to be part
of it? Why don't you two guys look at these two polls, and are there one or two people maybe who just want to work with them a little bit on that? See if they can figure out something to go with that? There you go. Why don't we do that? How about a few people, Stephen Crane, a little bit more serious, not a very long one, though. Do not weep, maiden, for war is kind.
What are you looking for?
We can take both men and women on this, yeah.
I'll do that.
Great. Pass one back there, too. Anyone else who might want to do that one?
Sure.
Great. There you go. You want to join up with this group then, too? Yeah. Just listen in on that, too, or help them out. And then we have several people who can work on Excelsior. You can probably do this with like five people, I'll bet.
All right.
Okay. Other people? And anyone who wants to, yeah, you should do this. Yeah. So they can't. You can just say the word Excelsior. There, oh, yeah, good part to do with that. So others, we can just hang out and chat amongst ourselves, or if you just want to circulate around and listen to other people. Good. Can we maybe pull folks back together again? Let's hear some poems. Just see where we are in our little workshop right here. Do we have a group that's ready? Are there Excelsior people?
Excelsior!
Excelsior on duty!
Yeah, if we want to use this as our little performance area, what I have. Here's the full text up here so other people can sort of watch along and sort of interpret maybe a little bit what's going on. Does that work for you guys? Is that okay? If you want to use this?
Well, we might just leap out there.
Yeah,
okay.
Then it sounds like real stuff. It sounds more like.
Here we go. So here we have Excelsior by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
The shades of night were falling fast as through an alpine village passed a youth who bore mid snow and ice a banner with the strange device.
Excelsior!
His brow was sad, his eyes beneath flashed like a falchion from its sheath, and like a silver clarion rung the accents of that unknown tongue.
Excelsior!
In happy homes he saw the light of household fires gleam warm and bright. Above, the spectral glaciers shone, and from his lips escaped a groan.
Excelsior!
Try not the pass,
the old man said.
Dark lowers the tempest overhead, the roaring torrent is deep and wide.
And loud that clarion voice replied,
Excelsior!
Oh, stay,
the maiden said,
and rest thy weary head upon his breast.
A tear stood in his bright blue eye, but still he answered with a sigh,
Excelsior!
Beware the pine tree's withered branch! Beware the awful avalanche!
This was the peasant's last good night. A voice replied far up the height,
Excelsior!
At break of day, as heavenward, the pious monks of St. Bernard uttered the oft-repeated prayer, a voice cried through the startled air,
Excelsior!
A traveler by the faithful hound, half buried in the snow, was found still grasping in his hand of ice that banner with a strange device.
Excelsior!
There in the twilight, cold and gray, lifeless but beautiful he lay, and from the sky, serene and far, a voice fell like a falling star.
Excelsior!
Ooh, great!
Wow.
That was great! Yeah, so you had some characters. There was a narration. We had a little bit of sort of stage move with some good use of the balcony up there. Great job, yeah. And no one really knows. Longfellow never explained, what does he mean by Excelsior? What is that? No one knows. So, anyway, that's that. Do we have another group that wants to do a poem?
Let's go with us.
Great, okay.
I know I did just volunteer my entire group. Not surprised.
Great. Should we put you guys over here? Then other folks can watch along and see the text and see what you're doing there. Stephen Crane, we know him best as a novelist, Red Badge of Courage.
Do not weep, maiden, for war is kind, because the lover threw wild hands toward the sky, and the affrighted steed ran on alone. Do not weep.
War is kind. Hoarse, booming drums of the regiment.
Little souls who thirst for fight.
These men were born to drill and die.
The unexplained glory flies above them.
Great is the battle god, great, and his kingdom. A field where a thousand corpses lie.
Do not weep, babe, for war is kind. Because your father tumbled in the yellow trenches, raged at his breast, gulped and died. Do not weep.
War is kind. Swift, blazing flag of the regiment.
Eagle with crest of red and gold.
These men were born to drill and die.
Point for them the virtue of slaughter.
Make plain to them the excellence of killing.
And
a field where a thousand corpses lie.
Whose heart hung humble as a button on the bright, splendid shroud of your son. Do not weep.
War is kind.
Nice. A really dark and sort of bitterly ironic kind of poem, too. That was great because, we were here. There aren't definite characters in here, but we heard many of the different voices that you would have heard, like in the Civil War, sort of reacting for it and for all those different points of views. Who's next? Who wants to go next? Okay. Here we have, let's see if I can find it.
Alice Lee stood awaiting her lover one night. Her cheeks flushed and glowing, her eyes full of light. She had placed a sweet rose mid her wild flowing hair. No flower of the forest e'er looked half so fair as she did that night as she stood by the door of the cot where she dwelt by the side of the moor. She heard a quick step coming over the moor and a merry voice which she had oft heard before. And ere she could speak, a strong arm held her fast and a manly voice whispered,
"I've come, love, at last. I'm sorry that I've kept you waiting like this, but I know you'll forgive me, then give me a kiss."
But she shook the bright curls on her beautiful head, and she drew herself up, while quite proudly she said,
"Now, William, I'll prove if you really are true, for you say you love me. I don't think you do. If you really you love me, you must give up the wine, for lips that touch liquor shall never touch mine."
He looked quite amazed.
"Why, Alice, 'tis clear you really are getting quite jealous, my dear."
"In that you are right,"
she replied.
"For you see, you'll soon love the liquor far better than me. I'm jealous, I own, of the poisonous vine, for the lips that touch liquor shall never touch mine."
He turned then quite angry.
"Confound it!"
he said.
"What nonsense you've got in your dear little head. but I'll see if I cannot remove it from hence,
she said.
'Tis not nonsense, 'tis plain common sense, and I mean what I say, and this you will find I don't often change when I've made up my mind.
I saw him look half so vexed, but she said,
if he talks all his life, I won't flinch.
And he talked, but he never could move her an inch. Then he bitterly cried with a look and a groan,
oh, Alice, your heart is as hard as a stone.
But though her heart beat in his favor quite loud, she still firmly kept to the vow she had vowed, and at last, without even a tear or a sigh, she said,
I am going. Sir William, goodbye.
Nay, stay,
he said then.
I'll choose one of the two. I'll give up the liquor in favor of you.
Now William had often great cause to rejoice for the hour he had made sweet Alice his choice. For he blessed through the whole of his long, useful life the fate that had given him his dear little wife. And she, by her firmness, won to us that night one who in our cause is an ornament bright. Oh, that each fair girl in our abstinence band would say, I'll never give my heart or my hand unto one who I ever had reason to think would taste one small drop of the vile, cursed drink. But say, when you are wooed,
I'm a fool of the wine.
And the lips that touch liquor shall never touch mine.
Great, great. Terrific reversal on that, too. Okay, we have a couple children's poems by Christina Rossetti. That's right. It's our wind up this part. Let's see if you find it.
No! 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 This is not the poem, actually.
But it's very simple.
No,
do you just want to do it right from this?
Yeah.
Great. How about we just bring it out here, thank you. Okay? So if you're here, and we'll move this out of the way then.
How many seconds in a minute? 60 and no more in it. How many minutes in an hour? 60 for sun and shower. How many hours in a day? 24 for work and play. How many days in a week? 7 both to hear and speak. How many weeks in a month? 4 as the swift moon runs. How many months in a year? 12 make the almanac makes clear. How many years in an age? 100 says the sage. How many ages in time? No one knows the rhyme.
So what were your characters there, you guys?
We kind of thought that he was studying, and I was quizzing him.
Great.
And then he wasn't really enjoying the study, but it was kind of, he knew all of it, and he's just like, I can rhyme to all of this. I'm so awesome.
Do you want to try the What is Pink then?
Sure.
Let's do the next one then.
What is pink? A rose is pink by the fountain's brink. What is red? A poppy's red in its barley bed. What is blue? The sky is blue where the clouds flow through. What is white? A swan is white, sailing in the night. What is yellow? Pears are yellow, rich and ripe and mellow. What is green? The grass is green with small flowers between. What is violet? Clouds are violet in the summer twilight. What is orange? Why, an orange. Just an orange.
Great. Nice, you guys. Good job, everyone. Thank you so much for doing those. Yeah, you can see how the poems that we think, you know, are just sitting on the shelf in the library in those big old anthologies actually can really sort of come to life. What's really difficult is what I think is when you take a piece of like very experimental stream of consciousness prose like you see there by Gertrude Stein in 1905. She wrote Ada a short little what she called literary cubism. She wanted to do in with literature what Pablo Picasso, her good friend, was doing with painting. And this is the result. This is the complete story, word for word. Later this evening, come back at 8:30, we will do the entire thing just as a short little play then, too. So won't that be exciting? But you don't just need to, you know, keep yourself to fiction and things like that. Sometimes you can just arrange things just through sort of a big kind of cut and paste kind of thing. And we're going to spend just a few minutes here right at the end just doing a little rehearsal. So we have four people who are going to be performing this later, and we're just going to rehearse this right now. So, folks, come right on up. Let's do 1, 2, 3, and 4 in this script. This is a piece that I put together just with my friend Joseph Scrimshaw, who does a lot of stand-up comedy and stuff like that, and sketch comedy stuff, just taking a look at all of our, that whole cacophony of secular traditions we have around December holidays and things like that. And it's really, we first did it, as you see, at the History Theater for a regular show. Then I did it later as a Reader's Theater piece. And it's really just, like, as it says, cut and paste of a lot of sort of Christmas and sort of holiday trivia. Let's just see what it looks like. Let's just read through it. And it goes pretty quickly, so whenever you're set, go.
Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. We're home for the holidays.
But which holiday are we home for?
It's December, the season of holidays.
Like Hanukkah.
Which is actually a rather minor Jewish holiday.
And Solstice.
Which is actually a rather major pagan festival.
And Kwanzaa, a unique African-American celebration created in 1966 by Dr. Malala Karenga.
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 It's about community culture and positive spirituality in general.
Traditional Kwanzaa gifts range from made Pan-African pottery to educational books.
Are you making fun of Kwanzaa?
No!
I guess all holiday traditions seem weird when you look at them up close. Even...
Christmas! Yay!
Food!
Presents!
Paid vacation time!
Excuse me? Christmas is when Jesus was born.
In point of fact, recent biblical scholarship indicates that Jesus was probably born in March.
Because shepherds wouldn't be tending their flocks by night in December.
It's too cold. The sheep would freeze to death.
Dead sheep.
That's not what Christmas is about.
Early church leaders decided to celebrate Jesus' birthday on December 25th.
That just happened to overlap with the wild pagan holiday of Saturnalia.
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 For centuries, Christians and pagans like reveled unchecked.
Food!
Presents!
Goats!
What?
Lots of holiday traditions involve goats.
The Puritans outlawed these wild pagan festivities. Christmas, as we know it, took shape in the 19th century. The Victorians made Christmas a time to celebrate children, home, and goodwill. Charles Dickens gave us a sense of community.
God bless us, everyone!
Queen Victoria and her German husband, Prince Albert, gave us the Christmas tree.
Vicky, we must have the Tannenbaum!
The tradition spread so quickly that within a few years, letters appeared stating,
"We had a Christmas tree again this year, just as always."
And finally, poet Clement Moore,
"Was the night before Christmas,"
gave us Santa Claus.
Ho, ho, ho.
Santa Claus brought us
food!
Presents!
Reindeer, which are all a lot like goats.
I was going to say, Santa Claus brought us the spirit of giving and charity and goodwill. Santa Claus was inspired by the 4th century Archbishop of Turkey, St. Nicholas.
Ho, ho, ho.
The real St. Nicholas gave gifts to the poor and was actually a tall, thin man, not
a right jolly old elf.
Ho, ho, ho.
Starting in 1863, Harper's Magazine published a cartoon of Santa.
He got jollier.
And fatter.
Every year.
Ho, ho, ho.
But there are other versions of Santa Claus around the world. In Belgium, he's called Sinterklaas, and on December 6th, he beats children with a stick, throws them in a sack, and takes them to Spain.
That sounds more like George Bush.
Our image of Santa finally took shape in the Coca-Cola ads from the 20s.
Ho, ho, ho! Buy Coke!
In Scandinavia, Christmas is still called Yule after the Yule log.
An early pagan tradition that involved goats!
No, it did!
Yes, it did.
Actually, the Yule log is meant to
honor me with your logs, little Norwegians!
What does that have to do with goats?
Thor's chariot was drawn across the sky by two magical goats.
We're talking about Santa Claus!
In Scandinavian countries, straw goats are still a popular Christmas decoration.
In the Swedish town of Gävle, a 43-foot straw goat is constructed every Christmas.
Unfortunately, it's been mysteriously set on fire 22 times since 1966.
This is the same year Kwanzaa was created. I'm just saying.
In 1970, the big goat was set on fire just 6 hours after being erected.
So the school children built a miniature goat to replace the big goat.
The little goat was smashed to pieces.
In 1976, a car crashed into the goat.
In 1987, the goat was fireproofed.
But burned down anyway.
Why are we still talking about goats?
In 2001, an American tourist became one of the few culprits actually caught burning the goat.
Yeah, I know it's against law. Everyone else is doing it.
He celebrated Christmas in Swedish jail.
Now residents say it just wouldn't be Christmas if the big goat didn't burn down.
And that's what December is all about. Traditions.
Food.
Presents.
And
don't say it.
I was just going to say children, home, and goodwill.
Thank you.
And goats, flaming Christmas goats.
Down, yeah.
Wait, just one question.
Yeah.
What's a Turkish accent?
Whatever. I know. What is a Turkish accent? That's what we should hear. Ho, ho, ho. That sounds more Jewish. Right. Great. So that's a way you can sort of create a reader's theater piece out of something that just really isn't theater at all, just by putting it together like that and just by juxtaposing little bits of information. These are just a few of the illustrations that probably... figure out right there. There's a lot of other different things that sort of get us closer to home, our church home at least. Probably a lot of churches do a different kind of passion readings on Palm Sunday. So this is an example of one where I was the narrator, and there's Sam Barwell in his greatest role right there too, where a lot of other people did that. So you can see it's sort of arranged. Now with scripture, obviously you're not doing that kind of editing. If you're going to be doing the passion story, and you're doing it not so much so that it's an interactive theater piece, but you're giving the word out to the congregation in that same way, but for a really long piece, like if we're doing this much of Mark, you're dividing it up just between different voices with the narrator, some of the different characters, a little bit of staging right there. We did this where I, as the narrator, you can see maybe a little bit from some of the stage directions there. I then moved around throughout the sanctuary then as that was going on. Yeah?
Just a quick question. I'm just curious why you made the choice to have so few voices, have voices take on multiple roles for this.
It's scheduling rehearsals.
Okay.
Yep.
Space.
Space, yeah, uh-huh. And because this way, if I'm moving around, let's see, how do we do this? I think we were able to put it so then Sam was at the center and all the other people were just at... on the side at another music stand, so it gave that sort of Trinity and also the sort of crucifixion kind of imagery. So you're just thinking about sort of the visual sort of symbolism that you're playing with as well. And what we did at the end, when we got to the end after Christ's death, then I just sat down as the narrator and the other folks then picked up the narration. They were starting to be able to tell the story then. Make sense? So it's just using a few little techniques or a little sort of tricks like that to bring the message forward, to catch people's ear in sort of a fresh, new way. Easter Vigil at Our Savior's Lutheran Church, where I go to it, a number of
people.
It's
amazing.
It's turned out to just be, it's sort of bubbled up over the last, 5 years or something, as being a really great service. Where, as you may know, the appointed literature texts for that evening are all of the Old Testament stories that are leading us up to Easter, to the New Testament then. So it's really a little bit about the community at that time gathering in vigil, telling the stories as the community draws closer and closer together.
So what we've done is we did some, throughout Lent, we did the Bible study on all of these different stories. And then either individuals, families, or groups, like even like the Sunday school, had an opportunity to take one of these texts and then retell it in a way that was meaningful to them. So that might be just reading it from the text because that means so much to them. Or it could be adding other elements that would be like children's storytelling, pageant. I think the kids did the Genesis, right? Is that right? Yeah, so we did the creation story then, adding movement, music, or other different theatrical elements to that. The one that I did last year was the Jonah and the whale story. I'll do that later this evening at 8:30 then as part of our theater thing. But you can see the area on this text, this is just the whole first part. What's not underlined is pretty much what you would find right in the Bible. The other stuff is stuff I put in, which is either sort of a joke kind of thing in there, because I think Jonah's pretty funny, or it also gives some of the context information that you would get from Bible study, but otherwise you wouldn't know some of that information. So it gives people a little bit of sense of like, oh, what's the story behind the story? How can we understand it better? Or it's a few things that are sort of articulating what maybe Jonah might actually have been thinking or saying, and what some of the other people, like the sailor and stuff like that, might be saying in response. So it's just imagining some of those things to bring that to life a little bit more. So I'll do that a little bit later then.
Great. I just want to share that the couple times that you've done things like this in church are the times when my kids have listened more than any other time. I mean, they'll hear something like, whatever, dude, and they're just sucked right in for the rest of the reading.
Yeah.
I'm like, did you hear that? He said, whatever, dude.
Church!
It's great. It's wonderful.
And so, thank you. Thanks so much. Yeah, it's so much fun to do that, to sort of juxtapose sort of us in our modern sensibility, in our modern language, with the ancient text, to try to see, like, how can we reconnect, and how can we connect again, and how can this word connect with the congregation then, too. So a little bit more on that later this evening. Well, we're coming right to the end of our time, so at 7:30 we have Vespers, and then 8:30, hopefully we'll see a lot of you back here once again to do...
And it'll be in here.
Yeah, it'll be in here, yep, and we'll do a little bit more theater. We'll hear The Origins of Christmas again, case of Vincent Kirwin, we will do that again too, and a number of other things, Jonah and others.
Could we burn the goat and sing?
So thanks so much. Thanks so much.